May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alan Eitzmas. I'm here representing the appellant Paul Hobday. This is a case that came from a post-decree motion before a judge in Hennepin County District Court. There are three issues primarily before the court today, but the real legal issue on all three of them is the standard of review, which is abuse of discretion. Did the judge in the post-decree matter abuse her discretion in her decisions on spousal maintenance, child care credit, and parenting plan? Now, respondents' argument basically, as I read it, seems to say, well, the trial court has discretion, and therefore, as long as they exercise their discretion, there's really little to be done. Well, that's not my view of the law, and that's not the view of the law that I read in the cases, because even though people have discretion, the discretion of a trial judge is not limitless. The discretion is governed by the standard of abuse of that discretion, and that's what we believe happened in this case. The first issue relates to spousal maintenance. My client made a motion to reduce his spousal maintenance. Now, the first problem that came up, which was a problem, was at the time of the divorce, which was 5 years, almost 6 years before, there had been no finding made as to what the budgets were of each of the parties. The finding was the husband claimed a budget and claimed a budget for wife, and the wife claimed a budget and claimed a budget for husband. But there was no meeting of the minds, and the budgets were diametrically opposed, at least at first blush.
But doesn't that put us in a difficult position? Because the way I read the law, and I'm sure you'll correct me where I'm wrong, it's, a district court has broad discretion on modification. It has to be particularly careful where there's a stipulation that governs maintenance. And even though there wasn't the marital status kind of issue resolved, we had this $15,000 a month maintenance agreement. So doesn't that actually give the district court actually even a little more leeway just to say yes, and I'm going to honor that stipulation?
In certain circumstances, I would agree with you, Your Honor, but not here, because a motion was made, and even though there is a stipulation and an agreement, the parties have a right to make a motion if there has been a substantial change in circumstances. And the trial court did find, with respect to one set of facts, which dealt with the income of the respondent, that there was a substantial change of circumstances. So therefore, the court can analyze whether or not the spousal maintenance should be modified. But my point with respect to the budgets was that there really wasn't that much difference if you actually looked at the budgets, because since there wasn't any agreement at the budgets, the trial court here decided, I'll determine what the budget was back 6 years ago. But she took into account four expenses that don't exist, two for the children and two for the wife. And we raised the children's expenses only because it reduced her overall budget. But those expenses were, there wasn't any private school, which was in her budget, and there wasn't a nanny, which was in her budget. Those two expenses were close to $5,000 or $6,000. On respect to the wife's budget, the wife put a budget in at the time of the settlement in which she contended that she had a payment for a cabin.
Mr. Agnes, help me understand, because okay. I looked at those budgets and thought, well, what the district court should be doing is looking at them not to say, well, what's happened since, but did they reflect the marital standard of living at the time to give her that basis for deciding whether the modification was appropriate? Isn't that the appropriate view of the district court?
Exactly, Your Honor. But at the time that she put her budget in, the respondent, she put into her budget back in 2012 expenses that didn't exist.
Well, but didn't the parties have a cabin during their marriage? I thought that was something that was part of that. Everyone agreed was part of the marital standard.
They had one cabin and one house. The husband got the cabin, the wife got the house. The husband doesn't put into his budget an expense for a house. He's renting a piece of property, much less than the house payment. The wife puts into her budget an expense for a cabin. At that time, she had no plans on buying a cabin. She had made no points to try and take a down payment. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that she was going to buy a cabin. She just put it in the budget because that's what I wanted to have. So
because that is what she had during the marriage, right?
Well, but she said that she wants to have it going forward because they only had one cabin and one house and each got one of each. One got the house, one got the cabin. So it was impossible for both of them to have the same cabin. So she's going to get a cabin. She needs, under the Rask case, to go out and actually find one. And if she'd found a cabin and had that in her budget, then that would be okay. But what she did since 2012 until now, she's never bought a cabin. She's never even attempted to buy a cabin, but she has a budgetary number, which is $4,625 in her budget for a cabin. She can spend it any way she apparently wants, but it's not the standard of living if she hasn't continued it. She had the ability to continue it, but she didn't do it. And therefore, but we get to get back, remember, at the time in 2012, there were two budgets, her budget and the husband's budget for her, and nobody agreed on what it was. So now you're looking at it in 2018, what was the budget? So you can't say in 2018 that the budget in 2012 included a cabin for her because she hadn't bought one, had made no efforts to buy one. And then subsequent to that, she still has not bought one and made no efforts to buy one.
So the compromise, $15,000 a month, was, as I read it, correct me where I'm wrong, kind of about halfway between the parties' two budgets in 2012. Fair to say?
I think the issue is not just the maintenance and the budgets, though, because maintenance is taxable. Her earnings are taxable, so you have to do an analysis, right, which was done by my client's expert at the time of this motion, saying that if you take spousal maintenance of $15,000, you take her income, you take the child support, which is not taxed, you'll end up with a net figure of about $15,100, which would be her budget, not what she needs in spousal maintenance, because she has her own income to meet part of that budget. So that's what she got, would be $15,000. Then you look at that budget and say, but did she really have those expenses? If she didn't have them under RASC, she can't say, well, I may have a cabin someday, therefore I get to put that in my budget.
But if she didn't have those expenses, your client stipulated to an amount that included some of them. And why does he get to go back and argue about that now?
Well, he didn't stipulate to those expenses. He stipulated that he had a budget for her and she had a budget, and they agreed to a number.
Right, but if at the time, you're saying, I mean, unfortunately, there weren't the findings originally, which obviously makes it a lot easier on a motion to modify, but if there weren't the original findings as to the actual budget, we know that the parties were aware of who owned the cabin and who owned the house. And regardless of that ownership or lack of ownership, there's a stipulation as to spousal maintenance.
Correct.
So it seems as if, and I guess that's what maybe that's what Judge Jessen is asking about. That's what I'm curious about as well. When you have the parties acknowledging a certain amount for spousal maintenance as being appropriate, even when there's no cabin, your argument in her expenses, your argument now is, well, there is no cabin, therefore you can't include that in the analysis. But the parties did, in fact, in some way consider the absence of a cabin not being a prohibition that limits the spousal maintenance at the original determination or the stipulation.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the issue is that at the time of the original divorce, it was stipulated that respondent got the house, appellant got the cabin. So appellant could not have a cabin expense in there unless she was actually going to be buying a cabin. And that's her representation, perhaps, that she was going to be buying a cabin, but she never did. So there's been a change in circumstances since 2012 because there are expenses that she said were in her budget no longer exist. And the other expense in her budget that we thought was inappropriate when the trial judge now said we're going to adopt her budget in total, without making any findings whatsoever about the cabin or any findings about the home improvements, she said she needed money each month, about $1,200 a month, for home improvements. Well, home improvements are not a budgetary item. Home improvements are a capital expense because she already had in her budget repairs, remodeling, and those types of things. But home improvements, she wanted to spend $80,000 to fix up the basement. She wanted to redo the driveway. She wanted to redo the carpeting. Those are expenses that you pay out of your capital budget, not out of your monthly budget that you're getting from your former spouse. And the trial court did not address either one of those specific arguments made at the lower level as to about those items in the budget. And as we pointed out in our reply brief, there was a case decided by another panel of this court in October of this year, in which the issue was, again, a modification motion, and the trial court at that point did not analyze the specific items in the budget. It basically said the budget as a whole was acceptable. Well, this court panel said, no, you've got to analyze each one of those factors. That's the Hammond versus Budnocker case.
But wasn't that a case where I was looking at a budget to establish maintenance as opposed to looking to see whether there's whether a modification is appropriate, whether there's been a substantial change in circumstances? Isn't that a different matter?
I don't think it matters when it comes down to analysis of the budget. If you're looking at whether the budget is reasonable and consistent with the standard of living, if somebody raises questions and says these are not consistent with her standard of living because at the time of the divorce they each got one piece of property, she can't have both pieces of property. And that's the argument that we make, Your Honor, which I believe is correct, is that the trial court needs to figure out, well, she never got a cabin, so is that a change of circumstances or not? We believe it is because the monthly payment and all the expenses of the cabin, you know, totaled over almost $5,000 a month, which makes a big difference in the spousal maintenance. The other argument on spousal maintenance goes to the respondent's income, where the trial court held that even though the parties had agreed that she would have a imputed income, if you will, of potential income or earning capacity of $65,000, working 32 hours a week, she was working less than that and was making only $42,000 at the time of the dissolution. The parties agreed, and the court found that potential income earning capacity was up to $65,000. Now she's making over $80,000, closer to $85,000, and the trial court said, well, it was foreseeable that she might make more money when the kids get older. Well, that's not what the parties agreed to. They agreed to earning capacity, earning potential, and she herself testified in her sworn affidavit that I'm working more now than we anticipated at the time of the divorce.
So figures adjusted for increased cost of living or any kind of computation there?
No computation of that was made, Your Honor.
So the original figure was not considering increases in potential raises or cost of living costs?
That's correct, because typically what cost of living does on spousal maintenance, it's cost of living based on the payor's income.
But as far as her income,
it was just a flat
number. When
they
were talking about potential of 65, they didn't consider that she might make more.
That's right. Yeah. And the trial judge didn't make that argument at all. The trial judge just simply said it was foreseeable if somebody was going to work 32 hours a week, they might work 40. But all the evidence, the document itself, and the testimony by affidavit from both parties at the time of this motion hearing was that the 32 hours was what she was expected to work, and she was now working more hours, as she said, than she'd ever anticipated at the time of the judgment and decree. And the trial judge did find that to be a substantial change of circumstances, but said it was foreseeable. Well, it wasn't foreseeable, and it is a substantial change of circumstances, and therefore the spousal maintenance award needs to be analyzed by the trial court on a remand as to whether a modification would be necessary because the substantial change made the order unreasonable and unfair.
The trial court, it appeared to me, also seemed to think that wasn't a reason for modification, but given your client's increase in income and looking at both of those, was that an inappropriate basis?
Well, the trial court never made that basis, Your Honor. The trial court said that the substantial change in circumstances had occurred, but because it was foreseeable, it wasn't an unreasonable and unfair order. Respondent argued that my client's income has gone up, but the trial court never found that as a factor in determining not to modify the spousal maintenance. The other issues, real briefly, are the child care credit, which I think is pretty clear that the respondent has gained $42,000 by not being honest, if you will. She knew she wasn't paying daycare, she knew she wasn't paying a nanny, and she accepted almost $1,000 a month for 2014, 15, 16, 17, and part of 18, and the trial court only allowed 1 year back, saying that, well, she probably couldn't afford to pay it all back. Well, first of all, the record reflects that she had $150,000 of liquid assets. And secondly, it would be a very poor precedent to set that the court would say, oh, she took the money, she knew she didn't get it, wasn't deserving of it, but we're not going to make her pay it back.
But the statute seems to give the district court that discretion. I mean, it talks about what it must do and what it may do.
Absolutely, but it's an abuse of that discretion to say because she can't, not because she can't, but because it's a large sum, therefore she shouldn't have to pay it back, and put the burden on my client to say, well, he should have known that he wasn't, that there weren't any daycare facilities anymore. That's not his burden. And I think the dissent of Justice Page in the Dakota County case really lays out the arguments on that. And it's a dissent because the laws, you know, it's at that point that the statute was must be only retroactive to the date of the filing. In this case, because of the discretion, but to be an abuse of discretion with the reasons given by the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Yes, may it please the court and counsel. My name is Lori Mack-Wagner, and I represent the respondent. I'm asking the court first to consider exactly what appellant was trying to do here. Appellant's motion was to drop the maintenance by $10,000 a month. And this was a maintenance that was agreed upon. It had, through COLAs, gotten up to $16,000. And the standard of review when we're looking at, well, what does the reviewing court have to look at? It has to look to see that the court exercised its discretionary caution or discretionary power with clear proof of facts, that the circumstances are markedly different from the time of the decree. And so we look to see, well, what was appellant claiming was markedly different? Because what would justify a $64,000 drop on an agreed amount of maintenance? Appellant's argument, well, it wasn't his own income, because the court found that his own income went up about $200,000. And he stipulated that he had the ability to pay. Instead, he focused entirely on my client's circumstances. My client is a nurse. We're talking it's income from, you know, $65,000 for 32 hours. She eventually, through the years, went up to $84,000, $85,000. The court made a finding when it came to her income that, in fact, when the court averaged all of her income between the starting point of the decree and the time that we were in court, her income was less than that $65,000. It was only a fairly recent thing that she was able to get up to the $85,000.
I don't understand how that factors in. Why would the averaging be the standard that's used if at the time of the motion to modify there was a significant jump in income?
Well, I think that the court did both analyzed it both ways. I think the court said, if I average it, this is what I find.
Why would averaging be? I'm trying to get a sense of why averaging would be the basis if it's clear that you have a substantial increase at the time of the modification motion.
And I think her point was to show, from an equitable standpoint, that there was no major windfall to my client.
We're talking about going forward. So
right.
As far as
and that's, you know, I don't know why the court did that, and I think it could be because
she
had a couple.
I'm asking you to defend it.
Yes. I think that she had multiple different jobs. It wasn't a job that was on an upward trajectory, so that she showed up until that point, this is the averaging approach. But then she did analyze it under the current income as well, the trial court did, and said, okay, I'm looking at the $85,000, and if I take the 32 hours and go to 40 hours, and I think it's anticipated that the children would emancipate, which two out of the four did, and Miss Hobday would decide to work full-time, that would be foreseeable. Now, I think there's a difference between being required to work full-time, because the judgment and decree did not require her to do that. She did that. One of the reasons that I think that was also foreseeable is if we look at the budget The budget's a huge issue. So at the time, the party specifically left it open for the court to come back and take a look at the marital standard of living. And the court did look at the marital standard of living, looked at what was presented by each party, and Ms. Hobday presented an expert report that looked at several years of actual documented expenses. Now, Mr. Eidsness talked about the cabin and how that wasn't a real expense. One of the things the court found that, yes, my client's proposal of what the actual marital standard of living budget was the only credible evidence that she had. The budgets by Mr. Hobday were not supported by documents. They were not divided between Ms. Hobday's expenses and the children's. And his own budget, when he didn't have the children as much as Ms. Hobday did, was greater than Ms. Hobday's. So anyway, she said, I agree that Ms. Hobday's expert's analysis constitutes the marital standard of living. The court then says, because I'm making that finding, I'm also finding that there was no way this level of $15,000 in maintenance combined with all her sources of income were going to meet that budget. Now, as a result of that, it means she doesn't have enough money to actually enjoy the standard of living. So she's going to have to liquidate her assets, which she did. Her children had all these unexpected expenses that, again, ran down her property settlement because she didn't have enough money.
Can you address the home improvement?
Yes, element? I can, Your Honor. With respect to the home improvement, I would encourage the court to look at the expert report because there is actually a history in the marriage. There's a section called Unusual Extraordinary Expenses, and it analyzes those from years 2002 to 2006. In there, the court will see that, yes, the parties did improve their home. This was something they did. They maintained it. They updated it. There was specifically a kitchen remodel in there listed. So to say that there's no history or basis and all she should be limited to is maintenance when this is the only asset, that significant asset that she's awarded out of the divorce, as, again, she spent down her property settlement for all these unusual expenses that she had regarding the children. But there is an evidentiary support.
Is there case law supporting the approach of taking a home, the fact that there had been a moment of a home improvement, that this works into an expense, that it's something that's done on an ongoing basis? There's one remodel. We're to suppose that there's periodic remodels?
Well, besides the history of remodels, there's also evidence in the record that Ms. Hobday said they had planned the basement remodel prior to the divorce and had that in the works, and that is actually in the comments of the expert report. I don't know of any specific case addressing home improvements, but what I do think is proper by the district court is to include that as a standard of living item. This is a affluent family, and basically, they had a house, they had a cabin, they regularly maintained. Plus, we do know that they had evidence of at least one major remodel, plus another one in the works. So those would be proper budget items. But again, when Ms. Hobday accepted $15,000, there were going to be some expenses that she just couldn't afford to do. And so that brings us to the court's finding that if this is the current budget, what is the income and resources available to meet it? She even today, she wouldn't meet her budget, even with the maintenance that Mr. Hobday is paying.
So let
right,
me.
But that assumes the budget is appropriate. And that's what I'm going back to. I recognize you say, I appreciate you haven't found any cases where a home improvement is included as an expense item. Have you found any cases where the approach would be justified in some other way?
None other than looking at what were the actual expenses during the marriage and how did the parties live, and just basing, I guess, integral to the standard of living is upkeep on the house.
Well, upkeep and modification are different things. And if the parties didn't have a remodeled basement or a finished basement, I'm not sure exactly whether it was a refinishing or a finishing, but either way, I'm wondering whether there's any support for what the district court did as a matter of law.
I'm not aware of any case saying as a matter of law whether it's automatically wrong to include a home improvement. What I am saying is that there is sufficient evidence to justify the trial court's adoption of the standard of living budget. It's not like it's a brand new expense.
So if I could go to another area,
yes.
I'd ask Mr. Idenis about the fact that my reading of the district court decisions was that in part the district court relied upon Mr. Hobday's substantial increase in salary as part of the reason for denying the motion for modification, and I'm looking at the part of the portion of the order which talks about other factors, and it leads into that. Is your reading that is something the district court relied upon, and if so, is that appropriate?
My reading is that I don't think the district court relied upon his income. I don't think that was really the basis for the request for modification, but I do think the court, when looking at the standard of living, did make a comment about how there's no question that he's living at the standard of living, and the court's looking at, okay, these people agreed to this level of maintenance. Now he wants to come in and reduce it by $10,000 for the emancipation of the kids, and because my client worked full time when she, assuming the budget was true, didn't even earn enough to, even with a maintenance and the investment on her assets, to do anything to pay for that budget. And so I viewed it more as stressing that the purpose of maintenance is to approximate the standard of living of the marriage. This is a long-term marriage. And then court talks about the benefits that Mr. Hobday received from my client. She worked to support them. He went into her family's orthodontist business. She goes through all the maintenance factors. And when she's left to decide what the accurate standard of living of the marriage is, that's what she came back to. I would like to address the cabin issue, because I think that's important. Mr. Eisen cited the Rask case, but the Kampf case talked about how the problem with Rask is that the woman's speculative mortgage payment that she had in Rask wasn't really related to the standard of living. In Kampf, the husband tried to use that and say, oh, well, her savings component of this budget, that's like speculative. And the courts distinguished in Kampf the Rask case, saying Rask doesn't apply here because, in fact, you did have a savings as part of your marital standard of living. And just like there was a savings component as a standard of living, there was a cabin. And again, my client reaffirmed that she intends to buy a cabin. She said all the reasons why she wasn't ever, you know, she had to pay down her property settlement. If the trial court is right, it makes sense that she wouldn't have had money to buy a cabin, because so many of her standard of living expenses went unmet. And so I'd like to touch upon the last thing about the equity, about the back child support. There's some child care support. There's some implication that my client was dishonest. I'm asking the court to look at it again to see there were numerous equitable factors. One factor only was that Mr. Hobday knew that there was no child care, but didn't say anything for years about it, and then sued her when it was a huge amount. Other factors included, which were equitable factors, is that he took an unreasonable position on uncovered medical expenses, particularly when the party's adult children, who are now adults, when they were minors, had mental health issues that were pretty expensive. the two girls who were supposed to, under the calculation of child support, go to Mr. Hobday's place, at least for part of the time, never did. So 100% of the expense was at my client's house. And then the other part was she had unofficial child care costs, which were the older children taking care of the younger ones. That had a financial consequence. And finally, she actually provided child care herself on Mr. Hobday's days, which involved some level of the expense. Looking at all of those factors, the court looked at the permissive language and found that equity justified some forgiveness of those costs, and that's what she did. So I don't think it's fair to say that my client was, quote, dishonest. My client also said in her affidavits that she didn't realize that she would have possibly have to pay all that back. Plus, she thought it seemed fair considering all of these other things that she was doing. And I know that Mr. Eisness didn't hit on the custody or the evaluator. I just wanted to say that, I think I'm up.
You can take a couple of sentences and wrap up.
Okay. Just that I think, just want to stress that the court did not say that it disregarded the report. It just said it didn't rely on the report from the custody evaluator. And if the court looks at all the evidence combating that, the report is lacking in credibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Eidness.
Let's address first the budget, because there's one thing that we need to focus on is the budget as found by the trial court at the motion was exactly what Ms. Hobday's budget was at the time of trial. And it's an exhibit to the judgment and decree that lays out the budget in detail. But on page 9 of that, it shows that her budget for herself is just over $17,000. And that's basically what the trial court found in this particular case. But two of the items on that budget, which were challenged below, were the cabin, which was on the budget, and the home improvements that were on the budget. Now, with respect to the cabin, counsel tries to distinguish the Rask case by the Camp case. But in Rask, there's no question that the parties owned a house. Mrs. Rask went out and put in her budget a mortgage payment, but the court said, even though they had a house before, she hasn't demonstrated that she's going to buy a house, and she hasn't demonstrated what it's going to cost. Here we have almost the same set of circumstances. We have a cabin that they had during the marriage, just like the Rasks had a house. Cabin was awarded to Mr. Hobday, and Ms. Hobday got the house. And now Ms. Hobday says, in addition to having the house, I also want to have a cabin. But at the time of the trial, which was didn't occur because they stipulated, she didn't have a house, didn't have a cabin. She'd made no effort to buy a cabin. And since 2012 until now, she still made no effort to buy a cabin. So it's not a legitimate budgetary expense consistent with the overall standard of living that both parties had to have together.
And I am troubled by the fact that if you take her $17,000 budget that, and you subtract the cabin and the home improvements, or even just the cabin, the agreed amount of $15,000 is, obviously includes some of that.
No, the agreed amount of $15,000, remember, is taxable. So you have to pay taxes on spousal maintenance. It's not that if your budget is $10,000 and you get $15,000 of spousal maintenance, you still have some taxes to pay. And then she had some income to factor into that. So it's all calculated together. And my client's expert, undisputed at the time of the hearing, showed that the net income to her was just over $15,000. The other point I'd like to make with respect to the income is that there was absolutely no finding made by the trial court other than the fact that she said it was foreseeable. Well, I think the evidence is very clear from both parties' sworn affidavits at the time of the motion that no one foresaw that she was going to be working 40 hours a week at the time of the dissolution. In fact, the parties agreed she'd be working 32 hours a week, and that would be the income that she would have as her income potential. The argument was made that the trial court found that there was no basis, I mean, that it was discretion to exercise not to require repayment of all of the daycare expenses, the child care expenses that had been paid. Counsel argued, well, because Ms. Hobday did these other things, that therefore that was an equitable decision. No, the statute says that you can only get these types of expenses for actual expenses paid. She didn't pay them. Now, if she had other claims that she wanted during this period of time, she could have brought a motion. She could have done all kinds of other things, which she never did. But the trial court said these were factors, but the main factor was the fact that it was basically unfair to have her pay it back because the amount had gotten to be so large. But if this court were to say that if you don't pay it back and then the amount is large, you never have to pay it back, that would be a very bad precedent to set because people have to rely on their spouses to tell them when this expense has gone away.
Are you saying the district court did not base its decision in part on equitable concerns beyond the amount?
Well, she listed those in her order, but she said the primary focus, I think that was the word she used, was on the fact that it would be too difficult to pay back because the number was so large.
Primary, but not only.
Not only, I agree. But it seems to me, Your Honor, that by doing it that way, she turns the statute of actual expenses are what you have to pay, not the fact that it was zero. That by doing that, it takes away the statutory basis for allowing people to rely on their former spouses to tell them whether the daycare expenses have gone down or not. It happens all the time. You have children, they get older, their expenses are less usually, and if they don't rely on each other to say what the actual numbers are, someone's going to continue to get a windfall.
Shouldn't you be able to rely upon a parent just to know how, as their children get older, they're not going to need daycare? I mean, isn't that kind of common sense, Mr. Idness?
Well, I think so, but if you are obligated by a court order to make payments and you make them and the person who is getting them knows they're not incurring the expense, the common sense would be, gosh, I really shouldn't be taking these funds because they're not for me, and tell the former spouse, you know, I'm no longer incurring those expenses, and that's how it should be done. If I could just have one more second.
Yes.
With respect to the expert in the child parenting time, the court did not say why she did not rely on that expert. The court just said, I didn't take it into account. Well, that's not an adequate finding. Here's an expert, well qualified, who gives opinions on the best interests of the children when it comes to the parenting plan, and the trial court just disregards it. The Mashad case says you can't really do that. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The matter was well briefed and well argued. We will take it under advisement and issue a decision within 90 days. And this is the end of our oral arguments for today, so the court is in recess. All right.